Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
No.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Okay, today, we're going to, let's open mic, anything you guys want to talk about. We're going to have a jump off topic of which I have on today's title, balling on eBay auctions and Facebook Marketplace. Okay. In other words, how you can earn some money. Matter of fact, you can make it in a career if you wanted to. Doing eBay auctions, eBay, and Facebook Marketplace. And there are other sites as well, but I've got experience on eBay, and I got experience with Facebook Marketplace. So we'll discuss it as a jump-off topic, then we'll talk about anything you guys want to talk about. Somebody even mentioned in a text I received on Native American reparations. But you know what? Before we go to balling on Baltic, let me play an audio frame from the Barefoot College for those of you who might not be familiar with the Barefoot College.
I'd like to take you to another world, and I'd like to share a 45-year-old love story with the poor living on less than $1 a day. I went to a very elitist, snobbish, expensive education in India, and that almost destroyed me. I was all set to be a diplomat, teacher, doctor, all laid out. I don't look it, but I was the Indian national squash champion for 3 years. The whole world was laid out for me. Everything was on my feet. Could do nothing wrong. And then I thought, out of curiosity, I'd like to go and live in a work and just see what a village is like. So in 1965, I went to what is called the worst Bihar famine in India, and I saw starvation, death, people dying of hunger for the first time. Changed my life. Came back home, told my mother, I like to live and work in a village. Mother went into a coma. What is this? The whole world is laid out for you, the best jobs are laying out for you, and you want to go and work in a village? I mean, is there something wrong with you? I said, no, I've got the best education, it made me think, and I wanted to give something back in my own way. What do you want to do in a village? No job, no money, no security, no prospect. I said, I want to live and dig wells for 5 years. Dig wells for 5 years? You went to the most expensive school and college in India and you want to dig wells for 5 years? She didn't speak to me for a very long time because she thought I'd let my family down. But then I was exposed to the most extraordinary knowledge and skills that very poor people have, which is never bought into mainstream, which is never identified, respected, applied on a large scale. And I thought I'd start a barefoot college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college. Went to this village for the first time. Elders came to me and said, are you running from the police? I said, no. You failed in your exam? I said, no. You didn't get a government job? I said, no. What are you doing here? Why are you here? The education system in India makes you look at Paris and Delhi and Zurich. what are you doing in this village? Is there something wrong with you not telling us? He said, no, I want to actually start a college only for the poor. What the poor thought was important would be reflected in the college. So then they gave me some very sound and profound advice. They said, please, don't bring anyone with a degree and qualification into your college. So it's the only college in India where if you should have a PhD or a master's, you're disqualified to come. You have to be a cop-out or a washout or a dropout to come to our college. You have to work with your hands. You have to have a dignity of labor. You have to show that you have a skill that you can offer to the community and provide a service to the community. So we started the Barefoot College, and we redefined professionalism. Who is a professional? A professional is someone who has a combination of competence, confidence, and belief. A water diviner is a professional. A traditional midwife is a professional. A traditional bone setter is a professional. These are professionals all over the world. You'll find them in any inaccessible village around the world. And we thought that these people should come into mainstream and show that the knowledge and skills that they have is universal. It needs to be used, it needs to be applied, it needs to be shown to the world outside that these knowledge and skills are relevant even today. So the college works following the lifestyle and work style of Mahatma Gandhi. You eat on the floor, you sleep on the floor, you work on the floor. There are no contracts, no written contracts. You can stay with me for 20 years, go tomorrow. And no one can get more than $100 a month. You come for the money, you don't come to Barefoot College. You come for the work and the challenge, you come to the Barefoot College. That is where we want you to try crazy ideas. Whatever idea you have, come and try. Doesn't matter if you fail. Battered, bruised, you start again. It's the only college where the teacher is the learner and the learner is the teacher. And it's the only college we don't give a certificate. You are certified by the community you serve. You don't need a paper to hang on the wall to show that you are an engineer. So when they said that, they said, well, show us what is possible. What are you doing? This is all mumbo jumbo if you can't show it on the ground. So we built the first Barefoot College in 1986. It was built by 12 barefoot architects who can't read and write. Built on $1.50 a square foot. 150 people lived there, worked there. They got the Aga Khan Award for Architecture in 2002. But then they suspected, they thought there was an architect behind it. I said, yes, they made the blueprints, but the barefoot architects actually constructed the college. We are the only ones who actually returned the award for $50,000 because they didn't believe us and we thought that they were actually casting aspersions on the barefoot architects of Thelonia. I asked a forester, high-powered, paper-qualified expert, I said, what can you build in this place? He had one look at the soil and said, forget it, no way, nothing can work. No water, rocky soil. I was in a bit of a spot, and I said, okay, I'll go to the old man in the village and say, what should I grow in this spot? He looked quietly at me and said, you build this, you build this, you put this, and it'll work. This is what it looks like today. Went to the roof, and all the women said, clear out. The men should clear out because we don't want to share this technology with the men. This is waterproofing the roof. It is a bit of jaggery, bit of urine, a bit of other things I don't know, but it actually doesn't leak. Since 1986, it hasn't leaked. This technology, the women will not share with the men. It's the only college which is fully solar electrified. All the power comes from the sun. 45 kilowatts of panels on the roof and everything works out of the sun. For the next 25 years, so long as the sun shines, I have no problem with power. But the beauty is, that it was installed by a priest, a Hindu priest who's only done 8 years of primary schooling. Never been to school, never been to college. He knows more about solar than anyone I know anywhere in the world. Guaranteed. Food, if you come to the Barefoot College, is solar cooked. But the people who fabricated that solar cooker are women. Illiterate women who actually fabricate the most sophisticated solar cooker. It's a parabolic Scheffler solar cooker. Unfortunately, they're almost half German. They're so precise. You'll never find Indian women so precise. Absolutely to the last inch, they can make that cooker. And we have 60 meals twice a day of solar cooking. We have a dentist. She's a grandmother, illiterate, who's a dentist. She actually looks after the teeth of 7,000 children. Barefoot technology. This was 1986. No engineer, no architect thought of it, but we are collecting rainwater from the roofs. Very little water is wasted. All the roofs are connected underground to a 400,000 liter tank, and no water is wasted. If we have 4 years of drought, we still have water in the campus because we collect rainwater. 60% of children don't go to school because they have to look after animals, sheep, goats, domestic chores. So we thought of starting a school at night for the children. We call the night schools of Thelonia. Over 75,000 children have gone through these night schools because it's for the convenience of the child, it's not for the convenience of the teacher. And what do we teach in these schools? Democracy, citizenship, how you should measure your land, what you should do if you're arrested, what you should do if your animal is sick. This is what we teach in the night schools. But all the schools are solar lit. Every 5 years, we have an election between 6 to 14-year-old children participate in a democratic process, and they elect a prime minister. The prime minister is 12 years old. She looks after 20 goats in the morning, but she's prime minister in the evening. She has a cabinet, Minister for Education, Minister for Energy, Minister for Health, and they actually monitor and supervise 150 schools for 7,000 children. She got the World's Children's Prize 5 years ago, and she went to Sweden. First time ever going out of a village, never seen Sweden, wasn't dazzled at all by what was happening. And the Queen of Sweden, who's there, turned to me and said, "Can you ask this child where she got her confidence from? She's only 12 years old and she's not dazzled by anything." And the girl who's on her left turned to me and looked at the Queen straight in the eye and said, "Please tell her I'm the Prime Minister." Where this percentage of illiteracy is very high, we use puppetry. Puppet is the way we communicate. You have Joachim Chacha, who's 300 years old. He's my psychoanalyst, he's my teacher, he's my doctor, he's my lawyer, he's my donor. He actually raises money, solves my disputes. He solves my problems in the village. If there's tension in the village, if the attendance in the schools go down and there's a friction between the teacher and the parent, the puppet calls the teacher and the parent in front of the whole village and says, "Shake hands, the attendance must not drop." These puppets are made out of recycled World Bank reports. So this decentralized, demystified approach of solar electrifying villages, we've covered all over India, from Ladakh up to Bhutan. All solar electrified villages by people who have been trained. When we went to Ladakh and we asked this woman, "This at minus 40, you have to come out of the roof because there's no place, it's all snowed up on both sides." And we asked this woman, "What was the benefit you had from solar electricity?" And she thought for a minute and said, "It's the first time I can see my husband's face in winter." Went to Afghanistan. One lesson we learned in India was men are untrainable. Men are restless. Men are ambitious. Men are compulsively mobile. And they all want a certificate. All across the globe, you'll have this tendency of men wanting a certificate. Why? Because they want to leave the village and go to a city looking for a job. So we came up with a great solution. Train grandmothers. What's the best way of communicating in the world today? Television? No. Telegraph? No. Telephone? No. Tell a woman. So we went to Afghanistan for the first time. And we picked three women and said, we want to take them to India. They said, impossible. They don't even go out of their room, then you want to take them to India. I said, I'll make a concession. I'll take the husbands along as well. So I took the husbands along. Of course, the women were much more intelligent than the men. In 6 months, how do we train these women? Sign language. You don't use the written word. You don't use the spoken word. You use sign language. And in 6 months, they can become solar engineers. They go back and solar electrify their own village. This woman went back and solar electrified the first village, set up a workshop. The first village ever to be solar electrified in Afghanistan were by the three women. This woman is an extraordinary grandmother, 55 years old, and she solar electrified 200 houses for me in Afghanistan, and they haven't collapsed. She actually went and spoke to an engineering department in Afghanistan and told the head of a department the difference between AC and DC. Didn't know. Those three women have trained 27 more women and solar electrified 100 villages in Afghanistan. We went to Africa and we did the same thing. All these women sitting in one table from 8-9 countries, all chatting to each other, not understanding a word because they're all speaking a different language. But their body language is great. They're speaking to each other and actually becoming solar engineers. I went to Sierra Leone, and there was this minister driving down at the dead of night, comes across this village, comes back, goes into the village and says, what's the story? They said, these two grandmothers. Grandmothers? Minister couldn't believe what was happening. Where did they go? Went to India and back. Went straight to the president. He said, do you know there's a solar electrified village in Sierra Leone? He said, no. Half the cabinet went to see the grandmothers the next day. What's the story? So he summoned me and said, can you train me 150 grandmothers? I said, I can't, Mr. President. But they will. The grandmothers will. So he built me the first barefoot training center in Sierra Leone. And 150 grandmothers are being trained in Sierra Leone. Gambia. I went to select a grandmother in Gambia. Went to this village, I knew which woman I would like to take. The community got together and said, I'll take these two women. I said, no, I'm going to take this woman. They said, why? She doesn't know the language, you don't know her. I said, no, I like the body language, I like the way she speaks. Difficult husband, not possible. Call the husband. Husband came. Swaggering, politician, mobile in his hand, not possible. Why not? The woman, look how beautiful she is. I said, yeah, she's very beautiful. What happens if she runs off with an Indian man? That was the biggest fear. I said, she'll be happy. She'll ring up in a mobile. She went like a grandmother and came back like a tiger. She walked out of the plane and spoke to the whole press as if she was a veteran. She handled the national press and she was a star. And when I went back 6 months later, I said, where's your husband? Oh, somewhere, it doesn't matter. Good money. Good money. Success story. I'll just wind up by saying that I think you don't have to look for solutions outside. Look for solutions within and listen to people. They have the solutions in front of you. They're all over the world. Don't even worry. Don't listen to the World Bank. Listen to the people on the ground. They have all the solutions in the world. I'll end with a quotation by Mahatma Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. Thank you.
All right, that was a little piece on the Barefoot College, and they've got a Wikipedia page and a few videos online. It's a pretty innovative college where, once again, they take what we would call illiterate grandmothers, but they're very literate, but that's a whole nother story, and they train them to become solar engineers, and they go back to their villages where there's no electric, on-demand electric as we know it in Western countries. And I know in one place where there was an electric company, they put the grid, they put the electrical grid out of business because they stopped buying from the grid because they know how to generate their own energy. So Barefoot College, very interesting. All right, today's podcast is titled Balling on eBay Auctions and Facebook Marketplace. And that's essentially about how you can earn money on eBay, doing eBay auctions, or you can set up an eBay store, or if you just have an item or two, you can put them up on eBay. We have people that are that have been supporting their families for probably 20 years now. Doing that just on eBay. And then, Facebook Marketplace, and I've made some money on eBay, and then, Facebook Marketplace, which I like better than eBay. But, and we're organizing a club here on It's My House. So, if you're interested in earning money online, was forming little Suzu's, little clubs where, you know, you got maybe two to no more than maybe five people in a Suzu or organized club, just two to five people, and you select, and I'll tell you what we'll be doing. We'll be copying a lot off of Amish economics, but, you know, we'll be some of the items that you find that you'll find in the Amish, that the Amish make, will be making them. Some of those items, we just got a handful, but we'll actually be making those and then selling. So we have an offline version that we'll be doing, as well as an online version of this, and we'll be using Facebook Marketplace, eBay, probably Craigslist, or whatever else is appropriate that individual group, that, you know, team, the organizers. All right, now, if you guys got any particular topic, I got an email earlier, not email, a text. And the question was, do Native Americans, Native Americans and reparations, okay. What are your thoughts on that? That was a paraphrase, probably not an accurate paraphrase of the text. But anything you guys want to talk about, just call 619-768-2945 and then press 1. If there's nothing you guys want to talk about, and also trending topics like I don't know what's happening with Kanye, but there's a lot of stuff on the internet about him, so if you want to talk about that or anything, give me a call. If not, we'll just wrap it up for the day early.
What?
Like that.
Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you didn't.
Hey, Jay! Hey! Jay! 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 Come back here! Jay!
You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk. Jay!
I need my money! Jay!
Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jay! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go and walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me.
In the first year of peace, more than 2 million couples were married. By 1950, 21 million babies had been born in a seemingly endless baby boom.
I came out of service out of the Navy in 46, and I wanted to go and marry the girl that was writing the 3 letters a week to me for 4 years, and she lived in Floral Park. I had a tavern there, and I moved in with the family. There was a mother and father, her sister and brother, and myself, and a baby coming on after a year.
Despite weeks and months of house hunting, some 3 million married couples throughout the country today are still unable to establish homes of their own.
When you look at the books that you read in school, you read of people in a house. You never read of people being living in an apartment, which we did, in trees. It sounds, and it's all new, you know, it was really something that you would like to have.
Guess I don't have to tell you, Mrs. Blandings, what a woman's touch could do to a place like this. Yes, sir. A couple of coats of paint, a little pointing up here and there.
Of course, we wanted our own house, and after, what was it, 2 years? Yeah, two years. In furnished rooms. And if you could see some of the dumps we lived in, it was really... Remember that attic room?
Yes.
In Jamaica? Yuck.
I've got to have a home.
No one is to blame, yet everyone is to blame. There's been a lag in home construction for more than 15 years.
In 1945, Americans needed 5 million new low-cost homes, and they needed them right away.
Now there are building materials.
The elusive dream of home ownership would soon be realized by a man about to fulfill a dream of his own and invent a new phenomenon, suburbia.
Bill Leavitt, as a young man working with the Seabees in World War II, has this brilliant idea, taking some of the techniques he's seeing right then and there in World War II, building airstrips, putting up housing for GIs, and bringing them back to America for ordinary people. He's sitting there at night with his pals in the Pacific in World War II and saying, you know, what do you want when you get home? Well, I want a house and a car.
Bill Leavitt's special genius was figuring out how to mass produce the American dream.
We first came to see that property where they were going to build. It was potato farms, and it stretched like from here to eternity. You would see concrete foundations, nothing but concrete with the heat in. And then down the road there, where in the midst of all the dust was a frame job going on. And then down on the dust was where he completed was the sheathing going. And then down the road a bit, and it was like putting your clothes on, from your socks on first, you know, and then putting your underwear on and the shirt, and finally way down on the other end.
It was a finished product.
It was a finished house. And yet, you could see how it grew.
Before the war, the average contractor built 5 houses a year. In Levittown, Long Island, they built 36 houses a day, a grand total of 17,450. Designed for a family of 4, Levitt's Basic Cape Cod sold for a minimum down payment at a price most people could afford.
I think there's a great ad in there. Mr. Veteran, you're a lucky guy. You know, you can buy this house with $100 down. The first day that they were going to sell them, the lines were, I mean, people started lining up 72 hours before the houses went on sale. Even Levitt was stunned.
A second Levittown in Pennsylvania was every bit as successful as the Long Island Levittown. Everyone, it seemed, wanted a Bill Levitt home.
I beg your pardon, sir. Would you mind telling me who you are and where you're from?
I'm David Poole from Atlantic City, New Jersey.
And would you tell me why you're moving here to Levittown?
Well, I'm working in this area now, and I've looked the houses over, and I think it's a fine place to raise a family, so I've decided to buy one.
Very good, sir.
My house was a little Cape Cod cottage with a trellis over the door and one window on either side, and it was 4 rooms, nice kitchen, an eat-in kitchen, decent-sized living room, 2 small bedrooms, and a bathroom, and it had doors that I could close and open and close and open with. We had always lived in furnished rooms. We had no privacy whatsoever, nothing. It was perfect for a young couple.
And we had a Bendix in the kitchen.
That's right, Bendix washing machine in the kitchen. First time I ever saw a washing machine, I think.
And we fell in love because that washing machine was underneath the stairs, you know. And before that, when we had the baby, you know, it was like 16, 17 diapers a day to wash, boil them on the stove. And needless to say, the family wanted to get rid of us, too. They didn't need a baby that was crying in that, you know, tight quarters. You know, and to have a house of your own, man, that was the way we felt, you know.
After the Depression, all this come on, so it was kind of a gift from heaven, you know, you found these wonderful houses to move in.
And the best thing about it, I guess, was our independence. It was the first time we were away from our parents, completely independent, and we did what we wanted when we wanted. Like any kids, they wanted to be on their own. And we were.
And we could start our family.
That's right. And the rapport between neighbors was, at first, was very good. Excellent, in fact.
Because they were all in the same boat as us. They were all first starting out. Mostly young like us, and just starting with their family and their first house, too.
The new middle-class families of Levittown had one other thing in common. They were all white.
I walked up to the salesperson, and I said to him, "We're very interested in your house, and we'd like an application." And I remember what he said to me. He looked at me, said, "It's not me, but the management has not as yet decided whether he's going to sell these houses to Negroes or not." And
you can't believe it. You really thought you had it made. You know, everything is falling into place.
Well, I'd like you to conceive that somebody telling you that, and there's no recourse, telling you that openly and outright like that.
Bill Levitt saw himself as a home builder, not as a social engineer, and he refused to sell to blacks. They were court cases against him, and the fact is he was all too typical of what existed in real estate in America in those days, in believing that you did not have to and should not have to sell to people who were not white.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is William Levitt, who heads the largest home building firm in the world.
Bill Levitt would become one of the richest men in America by providing architectural, not racial, equality.
Unlike anything we ever encountered before.
This is one of four models which are now being built throughout Levittown. The four models vary slightly in overall design, but each has the same number of rooms.
I think it was that sense that Americans really did like the comfort of having what the other guy had, but yet they could put a little fence around it and say, this is mine. And that's really a particular American genius, is to say, this is yours, this is mine, but we're still all the same.
Did you get all your dreams yet? Is this the first one?
An army of Levitt imitators carried the housing revolution across the country. By 1955, three out of every four houses built were built in Levitt-style subdivisions.
I think Levittown represented to a lot of city dwellers a dream that had eluded them all through the Depression and the war, which was to have a place somewhere with a patch of green in the back where their kids were going to be able to live better than they did. And to that extent, it fulfilled that particular vision. To another whole group of us growing up in cities, Levittown was a surrender. You know, that was exactly what we didn't want to be. To us, going to Levittown would be like going to Attica.
Its critics said that Levittown was little more than a voluntary prison. A multitude of uniform houses lined up at uniform distances on uniform roads in a treeless waste. What the critics said did not matter to the homeowners of Levittown. They had built sturdy new lives in sturdy new houses and wrapped their newborn into the nest. What worried many Americans was not the conformity of their own lives, but communist Russia.
Oops, I think I hit the wrong button. Okay, and I don't, if I can go back to, well, anyway, you heard most of the Levittown story. Bill Levitt, very innovative builder. As you heard, he was in the Seabees. Seabees is a military, the construction unit of the United States Navy. And some people call him the Henry Ford of, at least back in his day, in the Henry Ford of housing. He also called Donald Trump's dad, Fred C. Trump, the Henry Ford of housing as well, because he had two cookie-cutter houses. Yeah, I mean, he did a variety of residential buildings, but his bread and butter was he had a 3,900, he had one house that he built, residential house, single-family house for $3,999, another one for $4,999. But he built those. He did that like 27,000 times. That's Donald Trump's dad. And then you heard with Bill Levitt, he was doing, according to the audio I just played, he was doing 36 a day. 36 a day, you know, regular, not tiny houses, but regular, you know, suburban houses. I know he did. There was Levittown, New York, Levittown, Pennsylvania. He could have had other developments. I haven't researched that part of it. But anyway, for those that are interested in mass-producing homes or mass-producing anything, Bill Levitt. Because it was just him, his dad, and his brother. But, of course, they have tradespeople that, you know, actually carried out the work. But anyway, Bill Levitt, I think, it, you know, he's somebody that, if you're interested in that type of thing, assembly line building or assembly line anything. I think Bill Leavitt is a good person. Study how he did it. I had a text earlier today, and if you guys want to talk about making money on eBay and Facebook Marketplace, we can talk about that. But it's open mic today, so we can talk about anything you want to talk about. So I'm referring to a text that I got earlier today, and it dealt with the topic of reparations, particularly Native Americans and reparations. So let me put out a picture. Let me attempt to paint a picture using numbers, because I'm a stat guy. Now, generally speaking, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just doing a very simplified thing of reparations. And you have different groups who in contemporary times have received reparations. And in 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which was reparations for Japanese Americans who were, you know, caught up in the that stemmed from I think Pearl Harbor, and they put Japanese Americans in the United States in what do you call internment camps? Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But Ronald Reagan signed the 1988 Civil Liberties Act, which cut a reparations check to specific Japanese Americans who were involved or affected by that. All right. Now, that's a check. Now, reparations, if you look up the word, it can mean different things to different people, and it can take place. The form of reparations could be different. Some people are happy with a check. Some people are looking for something else. Could be land. Some people just want the opportunity to do it themselves, and that's what I call do-it-yourself reparations. So here's the picture I want to put out there. Okay. Why look for a check or anything coming from a governmental entity when you can, if you take a look at the landscape, and I'm going to call this reparations chess because I like to use chess in a lot of my analogies. Let's look at the chessboard. If you know, the chessboard represents the landscape, and in this case, it's the landscape of the earth and the landscape of the United States. Okay, let's look at the chessboard. Now, the chessboard's got 67 squares. So let's try to attempt to paint a picture of what's out there. All right. And what do you really want or you think you deserve or anybody? All right. Globally speaking, there's 126 billion acres of land on the planet. 126 billion acres of land on the planet. Now, let me look up real quick acres of land in the United States. Acres of land in USA. All right, there are 2 billion. Let me look at it. There are 2,400,000,000 acres of land. Actually, it says the United States has more than 2,400,000,000 acres of land. That's land and water in the United States. All right. All right, one says 2.3 billion. So let's go with the lower number, 2.3 billion acres of land in the United States. All right. In the United States, which has a population of over 320 million, 86% of the 320 million, and that includes the over 8 million that live in New York City, and I'm not even including the New York City metro area, but, well, you know, let's throw that into the New York City metro area, which is over 8 million, or actually metro over 10 million, Chicago over 3 million, Los Angeles over 1 or 2 million. 86% of the population of the United States occupies only 3 to 5% of the available landmass. That's it. So 95 to 97% of the landmass of the United States is essentially rural, and a part of that is unoccupied. It's wilderness. Let's see. Okay. All right. So let's go with the lower number here, 95%. So in the United States, you've got 2,185,000,000 acres of land that for the most part is rural, and probably about 22% of that is wilderness. Wilderness meaning that no human being, as of 2022, today's date, whatever it might be, October, whatever, hasn't even set foot in 22% of the land in the United States. So my whole thing is, because if you're on that, if you, once again, you got 86% of 320 million people that they just occupy only 3 to 5% of the available landmass. That's where it gets competitive, supply and demand. Now, me, I'm an extremist. Give me the land that's on the 95 to 97% where there's dramatically less or virtually no competition, or really no competition at all. Many people that are homeless, many people that are dealing with social problems, many people that are struggling with housing problems, issues, or whatever. If you would just expand your comfort zone, and it depends on where you are in the United States, by 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, for some of you, it might be 90 minutes. If you expand your comfort zone by anywhere from 30 minutes to 90 minutes, radius of where you are right now, if you're in a troubled area or an expensive area or area where you're really struggling to make ends meet, if you just, like I say, in any, well, almost in any direction, go 30 to 90 minutes outside of that, you'll find a sustainable world. Now, you're probably going to have to develop some skill sets that you don't have right now. Because number one, I'll give an example. I purchased 10 acres of land via eBay about 6-7 years ago. And for $2,000. That's 10 football fields. An acre is about the size of a football field. So that's 10 football fields for $2,000. That includes recording fees, taxes, the whole nine yards. All right. Now, granted, there's no bus line nowhere near the 10 acres. There's no Wall Street. There's no Wall Street. The nearest Walmart might be 2 to 3 hours away. All right, I can go in town, and there's a town near the 10 acres where I can get all the basics I need. The town has about 1,700 people, something like that. But all the basics I can get right there. But essentially, I can live, and I haven't decided to develop this 10 acres, but I can live, or put it this way, the problems that you might have in a Chicago or Seattle or Miami are nowhere near this 10 acres. But granted, once again, you have to have the skill set or develop the skill set to, and anybody can learn a new skill set if they're willing, to set up shop and have a sustainable lifestyle, you know, because the property taxes on the 10 acres for right now is less than $150. Matter of fact, where is it? I just got the tax bill. Let me see. Oh, here we go. I just got the tax bill a couple of weeks ago. Wait a minute. Okay, here we go. I found it. All right, the tax bill on my 10 acres in a particular county in Texas right now, if I pay this month, this is October, if I pay this month, it's $31.20. If I wait until June of next year to pay the taxes, which I'll be late, but if I wait till June of next year to pay the taxes on this 10 acres of land, it's $37. Now, it's 10 acres of raw land. I've got a house in Washington, D.C. on a little lot that's not even a quarter of an acre. And the taxes on that is $5,000 a year, $5,000 plus. Now, you don't have to go as far away as I did. You can go to parts of West Virginia, parts of Western Maryland, parts of Southern Maryland to find you. And, you know, we'll go into the more detail on that on another day. But now I'm saying all that to say this. For those who want reparations or whatever, is instead of waiting on the government to, because, that's an expensive process. You need lobbyists. You got to get legislation passed. You got to get stuff in the think tanks. People have to vote on it. And you might not live long enough to see that check or land or whatever form of reparation that you want. All I'm saying is with the United States having over 2.3 billion acres of land available, that's total. And the majority of people, 86% of the population, is crammed into those 3.6%. Excuse me. 3% to 5%. You got that many people crammed into that. Because you have people that live in New York City that they've never been to a rural area before. All they know is the five boroughs or their particular borough of New York City, Manhattan, Bronx, Queens, Staten Island, Long Island, Brooklyn, those places. There's some people that live on the west side of Chicago that have never been outside of Chicago. So anyway, That's how I'm looking at reparations. It's do it yourself, go out. I mean, that's what Levitt did. Levitt went out and bought land, and he would develop, he and his brother and his father, 11 sons, that was the name of the company. That's how they did their thing. So in 2022, and we're getting ready to go into 2023 here soon, there are over 2,185,000,000 acres of land, acres of land that you can buy in this country at unbelievable discounted prices. However, you're going to have to probably develop some skill sets and expand your comfort zone. Or do you want to live in, Los Angeles, where you might pay $700 to rent a room in somebody's house? Just like we talked about the other day, or a couple of weeks ago, at UCLA. They have a safe parking program for students at UCLA who have a car, but they cannot afford to rent a room. They can't afford to share, which includes a shared housing, because housing in that part of Los Angeles is super expensive. So UCLA came up with a safe parking program. You can read it on Facebook. They got a Facebook page. I'm just saying, there's no silver bullet for everybody. Different strokes for different folks. And on that note, once again, if you guys want to talk about anything, it's open mic today. If you want to talk about Kanye, I don't know what he – I'm way behind on that, so I don't know what he said or didn't say. But if you know, call up, press 1, we can put you on. Or any topic in the world, if not – we'll shut it down for today. I got to find my studio first. And we'll be back on Sunday evening. We added an extra day on Sunday. We do a Sunday night 10 or 15 minute one, but that's more like a motivational thing to get ready for the week. Let's see. Any event, it's open mic trending topics. If you guys want to talk, if you don't want to talk, then I can knock off early for today. And for people that are interested in inexpensive living, I mean, how to buy inexpensive land, check out eBay, because that's where I picked up the 10 acres. Okay, 309 area code, your mic is open.
Hey, good morning. It's Chris Collins here.
Good morning. Good to hear you, Chris.
Man, you just talking about the billions of acres and, you know, being out here in the rural areas. The thing is do what he did. He developed. You bring in the resources. You don't have to drive as far. We can make sure that there's not a food desert anywhere, but we can also, you know, take the desert and turn it into living habitat. So, you know, I love it, and I just thought I'd expand on that a little bit, you know, and not just.
Please do, and I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up, because you're right. You can bring in your own. You can bring in the resources that your particular community needs. You're absolutely right.
Yes, we need to meet those needs. That's the one thing that all of us in the world always have, is we have a need. And main thing is shelter. Number one is food, water. These are things that we need. Now, we also need to know we're not alone. We're not in this war alone. So you bring in those resources. But the mental health, you know, when, as I've been partnering and collaborating, I've got organizations, you know, that are veterans organizations. I got organizations that are brain injury organizations, just mental health itself, prison parole programs, right out of jail, you know, using the local jail. The thing is you have able bodies throughout America that are sitting in a cell not having a purpose. You know, that needs to change. We can set that up in a rural area. Then we're not putting them inside of a city, but they're also fixing your problems in your city. And then when they do show up, they're not going to be looked at as the problem. So that would be a solution, you know, a resource to tap into, because we got to stop this recidivism. We got to change the narrative of what we are living. It's not about how much you can get out of this world. It's what are you going to leave? And, you know, 100 years ago, a squirrel could get in a tree and go from Mexico to Canada and never touch the ground. But we know when Eisenhower signed the highway thing, it changed things, but it also changed all these things that we're talking about, these byways. Because we can now, we can get to them. There is roads. There is this. And when you look at all the forestry that gets burnt up, just from Mother Nature. But if we could beautify it right back and do something amazing by, you know, bringing the community together. All right, thank you. And, yeah, I'll let you see.
Well, I agree with you. Matter of fact, somebody sent me an Instagram link, last 24 hours or so. Yeah, yesterday. And it was a man out in Los Angeles that he started out living in a tent on a sidewalk, but they took that away from him. So what he did was he built a tiny house on the sidewalk, and he built it on casters wheels. And it's good, solid work and whatnot. And the merchants on this particular block where he built it on the sidewalk, and he's not obstructing the sidewalk. There's plenty of walk space in and around his little cabin. But everybody was all right until all his neighbors were good with him until I guess one of the local news channels did a report on it. So that put him on the radar. So now he's got to move it. But I'm putting that all out there, Chris, because there are quite a few. And he's refused city services and whatnot. And he's self-employed. He knows how to make money. He knows how to repair bikes and all that. But I brought that up because you have a lot of homeless, tent cities, I guess, in various places in the United States. I know in Tampa, which is about 30, 45 minutes away from me, they've got one, if not two. But then you also have some cities, I don't know if it's a whole lot, you know, that they're setting aside places for people to, I guess, lack of a better word, camp. But do you think that city, now, Los Angeles, now, this is one thing about Los Angeles. Los Angeles now has, I think the city controls it, a tiny house village. But do you see more cities adopting or jumping on the bandwagon with the tiny house village as a way of them generating revenue? And how do you think it will affect private enterprise, like just the regular citizens that want to live in a tiny house and become a tiny house developer?
Well, I do believe that people realize they don't need to necessarily live in a 2,000-3,000 square foot home. They got all these rooms they don't even walk into. It's more of a vanity thing. If you lived in what you needed, And do I think California? I had something to do with what they got going in California, and I'm proud of it because showing the governor and all of the legislators how many positive reasons there would be to build it and build it out of a certain material. So we got some legislation passed in November that is building 42,000 tiny houses in California. They're letting private industry get involved, and they're taking in the money. It needed to be more set to taking the poverty that we're trying to work with and turn it to prosper, because $5.8 billion budget, not including any money that any city has in California. Mm-hmm. I've got a project that I'm actually presenting to Los Angeles and Inglewood and Compton, all the cities. And what we're doing is we're taking five lots. We're building 2,500 tiny houses called stat houses, and they're superior to a tent. And this is level one. It runs on a 90-day program. In 90 days, if we can't get these people off their feet or off the street and on their feet, then it gets reevaluated and they go for another 90. But if mm-hmm. we can move them into level two is a permanent supportive housing. So you're moving from transitional housing into a permanent supportive housing, comes with services. Then if you're not needing the services, you can then move to level three and just have an apartment of your own. You've got a job, you're paying the bills, everything is going. Level four, it's a home, not just a house, but it's a home because we can actually teach people how to have a home by not necessarily having there's not a household out there that's not dysfunctional in some way. Right. And if we look at all these dysfunctions and we create something that takes away the dysfunction and makes it functional, that's the best part, because we're taking out that dis. And I'm tired of seeing people get dissed, and if they don't have something, they look down upon them, and everybody thinks that because this person's homeless that they're worthless, and they got the same equal rights as everybody else to take a breath of air. And the funny part is I found out I was always taught that trees created our air, and they don't. They filter the air, but they don't create the air that you're breathing. So it was something, you know, we got to look at what we're teaching and what we're teaching right. Our kids. Our kids are the solution to every adult's problem. They're inheriting every one of them. And then they always say, well, the children are the future. No, the children are the now. They will create the future because they're creators every second of the day, and they don't realize that what they're thinking about and they're imagining can become reality by sharing it, by doing it, by making action from those thoughts, because every dream is just a reality that hasn't happened yet. But
true,
as you spoke about, you know, what Trump and them did, you know, they had vision. They turned around and they did something. And what did it do? It sparked income. It sparked economy. If people make money, they spend money. Well, that means all the local businesses are now making money. Now we've got it down to the service industry, and everything's drop shipped to your front door. People ain't going to the stores. That's why the malls are closing. So let's utilize those malls. Let's turn them into incubators for not only the youth, but for humanity, because we've lost what it's supposed to be a human. You know, we're the human race. One race. There's no other. If there is, you're an alien. You came from somewhere else. So we're the human race. We're human beings, but we're not being human. Now, do you have to live in a 3,500 square foot home? No. Do you have to drive a Lexus? No. Do you want to? Yes. There's the difference. A need and a want. There's so many needs that need to be met. What I want is them met. That's my want. If they get met, that means it's safe for my children to be able to go across town and not worry about getting picked up, because people aren't out on the street trying to survive, trying to not necessarily our children being picked up, but you don't know. I mean, it could be a stray bullet. We need to take the guns out of people's hands and realize you don't have to walk around with a pistol and be afraid. If you want to put a pistol grip in your hand, I got one, but this one saves lives. It don't take lives. So we need to change the narrative, you know, and it comes down to what we say. Because if we turn around and we talk about the negatives of about what racism and stuff has done, reparations and all this other, you know, I say reparations is preparations. And I think it was kind of what you were saying earlier. So I think there should be a reparation, but it should be from all of us, not from us saying, give me. It's what can you give? You know, if you were able to change the narrative of 5 to 20% of the money you're spending on a daily basis to do something positive, what would that do? What would that do to your income at the end of the year? You got a ten, let's just do an average of a 10% raise. So if you made $100,000, you made 110. So what could you do with that extra 10? You didn't have it in the first place. You were already giving it to the profit companies. So why not give it to our children? Why not give it to the people that are in poverty, that never had a chance because they were born on this side of the street, and actually turn around and give them a future? I've got a tent city. You know, you just mentioned it. I have a tent city on my property. And my city just fined me $7,360 for giving those people a place to lay their head. Because it looks bad. I got 2.5 acres and it looks like a golf course. They got it mowed better than the rest of the yards in the neighborhood. Two of them are better.
Speaking of tent cities, and some of these politicians, I believe, need to go over to Mongolia. In the, I think 30 to 40% of the population of Mongolia are they're nomads and they live in yurts. Yurts are nothing but tents. And in their capital city, Ulaanbaatar, in Mongolia, which is an urbanized city by Western standards, they have a good section of that city. What we would call a tent city, but they like to say what they call their tents are yurts, which, you know, they're aesthetically pleasing. And I mean, people just look it up. If you don't know what a yurt is, just look it up online. Y-U-R-T, or Mongolian yurt. You can have, they got yurts over here too, but they're tents and they've been around for thousands of years. But, so, yeah, Chris, what you have is what I would call innovative. Is this the powers that be there, they haven't caught up to your thinking yet.
No, but not in my city. They have in others. Like I said, I got legislation passed. I'm in Illinois, and I got legislation passed in California by sharing the information with them and asking them to write it into legislature, make it a law, give us a reason that we can actually change this season. They stepped in November and launched it. They have not done it in the correct way because they're not giving these people a purpose at the same time as they're taking them off the street. Let somebody walk in a home or a house and think they're going to be okay. If that was the case, they would have already been in that situation. And people need a purpose. They need to know they have one. Every person listening, every person that's not listening, you all have a purpose. And I didn't know what mine was until I was 32. And here I am 50. And 18 years later, I'm able to be here with you, sharing with the world, let's do this. Not talk about it. Don't need to talk about it. We've already had a few times this week. We've already shared. We don't need to talk about it. We need to do it. And I love the fact that we're booking, we're making this stuff happen. And, you know, we're even connecting offline and having these conversations because people are reaching out that have heard about the discussions that we've had.
True. You're right. You're right.
And we got to be the change we want to see. And what I'm seeing is that change. I've met a lot of people. I've met over a million. And you need to be accountable for what you say. You say something, you got to be accountable for it. I've had a million people not be able to tell me one reason not to do this program. But I don't have a million people standing behind me right now saying we're doing this program. They all said they would, but their words aren't true. If you're going to speak something, mean it. But if you're going to hurt someone's feelings, keep it to yourself. You can scream it all you want inside. But if you're going to make a promise, you want to be that change, you got to ask yourself the question, who are you when no one's around, when you get to create or make a sound? Because it's what you do in your forefront of your mind. If you can pull something from the back of your mind and keep it up front and know that it isn't about me, it's about we. That's the problem with the world today. They worry about what they have and what they're going to get. And they say, oh, my family's not going to do like that. Well, I'll tell you what, 90% of this country is 90 days away from homelessness. I don't care if you own your house or what. Because if you don't make the payment to that mortgage, the bank will come and take it. And all you got to do is lose your job. So
that's a scary thought. That's a very scary thought.
That's a straight reality, though. It is real.
That's true. You're right. Rent courts are – and rent courts alone are packed every day, Monday through Friday. And a lot of those people – they're scrambling to find a new place to live. But all right, let me ask you this, Chris. Now, you have some people, they keep on looking for the solution within the city. And what do you tell people that, you're right, well, if you live, what about looking 45 minutes away or outside of the city? How do you help those people if you can? Because they basically, I think they have to expand their mindset. Because, like you said, you can put the services or whatever they need. You can develop your own community for whatever you need, and you have everything you need right there in a rural area.
That's right. And all that is job creation. That's working with the colleges. You know, if we got students, you know, that are wanting to be psychologists and they're going to college for it, what better experience is actually experiencing somebody's mental capabilities and what they go through and how they process? Because as me and you having this conversation, there's not one person listening that's going to receive this message the same. Because
no.
All of you go and tell three people what you just heard, you're going to give them a bunch of different stories. And by the time it gets back to me, I wasn't even in it. So
true.
I've seen that so many times. But it's also, you know, we put so much in the back of our mind because our subconscious brings in 200,000 megabytes of information per second. That's a lot of information. Do you know, as me and you're talking and everyone's listening, you're only bringing in 40 megabytes of information on your conscious level? That's mind-blowing right there. I know
right. The
parts of my brain that I'm not using is taking in so much more and absorbing everything around me, and I can't even think about it because my brain is not processing it. Nowhere near what it could. But here's the one way you can help your brain: by visualizing it. If you see it with your eyes, you process it 200,000 times faster than you do by hearing it. Because you're trying to envision what I'm saying and put it into a picture. You are working parts of your 40 megabytes that you don't need to. Because if you see it and put your hands on it, feel it, and know it's real, there is no doubt, and you don't have to move in that other direction. I do have somebody calling me. So.
No, that does make sense. That does make sense. You got to take a call, Chris?
Well, yeah, I have somebody calling in. I can call her back, though.
Okay. Well, yeah, we, like I said, we're working on planning, these retreats or workshops with speaking, using speaking, where people can actually see that. Matter of fact, I'm going to play this quick audio that is one way we can do it.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
She may not be Goldilocks, but a woman makes herself right at home in a property that doesn't belong to her.
Now, the homeowner wants this woman out of her house, but she's having a tough time giving the squatter the boot. Fox News' Taryn Asher live in Detroit with more on the intruder who just will not leave, Taryn.
Yeah, and you know what? She just came home right now, but we've been waiting to speak with her all night because the homeowner says that she unlawfully walked into the house, took ownership of this house, and has been living there and refuses to leave. She just pulled up right now, and before we get to our full story, ma'am, what do you have to say about that? Are you a squatter?
No, I'm not.
Why are you not a squatter?
I would like to park my vehicle if you don't mind.
Well, we would like to know because this woman says you moved in and you won't leave and she owns this house.
I'll tell you my credentials as, you know, why I'm here.
She says that you said this was part of a program.
I have a construction lien for the repairs that I put into the house. Someone had broken into the house on July the 4th and they stripped the radiators and I made a report.
But she said that you broke into this house and
you have
been living here because you said that you have the right to live here.
I've been released with her since October 9th, 2012. And then in February 2011, we had to vacate because the boiler was damaged. The only thing I took, I own Little Egypt Publishing Company. I took all my books and my writings.
All right, well,
but my furnitures were still left in here.
One more thing. She also said that you said that this was part of a program, that you felt that anybody who can go into Detroit, take over an abandoned house, and live there.
Well, I'm an advocate for affordable housing. That's a part of my campaign as a U.S. writing.
Did you say that to her, and do you believe that?
Well, I believe that since I met her, the first time I met her when I was running for state senate, 2010, and she was also running for political office. That was a part of my belief. I signed an oath pledging that I would fight for affordable homes.
All right, well, ma'am, maybe we can talk to you about this a little bit more in a moment. There's a lot to this story. Take a look what the homeowner had to say about this.
You can't get any houses like this anywhere in America, especially for this price.
Heidi Peterson always dreamed of living in an historical home. In May of 2010, she bought this one in Detroit's Boston Edison District for $23,000. After being away for a year, she returned home last week and realized she got way more than she bargained for.
I told her it was my house.
She says a woman was living in her house, the one who put her pictures on the mantle. Heidi learned from neighbors she'd been living there for a few months. Heidi claims the squatter changed the locks, reworked the plumbing, replaced her appliances, put a lien on the house, and even changed the curtains. And now the squatter won't leave.
She locked the door, so.
So now they are forced to sleep one room away from each other. Heidi with her one-year-old daughter.
People would find this odd that you're living with a squatter.
I guess something that happens in Detroit.
An unusual situation and, as we discovered, not your average squatter. Her name documented all over the house, missionary Tracy Elaine Blair, a write-in candidate for president.
Do you feel safe?
I don't know. I don't know what the capabilities are. We're afraid of her mindset of entitlement.
A squatter doesn't have a legal right to the property, but under the law, the homeowner cannot remove a squatter by force. In most cases, the homeowner has to file a civil action in court, prove it's their property, and evict the squatter. That's what Heidi is trying to do.
She thinks that this is a program in Detroit to take people's homes and fix them up, and then she gets to keep them.
Because Heidi spent all of her money on this house, she says she can't afford to go anywhere else. And until she can legally kick the woman out, they are forced to live under the same roof.
I thought, if the house is not safe, how can I come here with my child? There's an issue with that. But should I lose my house to a squatter because I don't have rights to my property, or should I fight to get it back?
And Heidi also claims that things have come up missing in her house, that it's certainly not the way that she left it. But, of course, you heard the woman, the supposed squatter here, and she claims that there was a lease. Heidi said there was not. We have not been able to see that, but she also says that she has the right to be able to live here if she fixes up the home. So there is clearly a lot to the story, and this is a perfect example why police don't go in when they're called and just remove someone from the house, because they don't have that proof on who actually lives in the house. And that's why, like in this case, the woman has to go to court, get an order of eviction, and show prove that she owns the house, and then evict the woman that lives there. That's why there is a legal process, and it would take 30 days to get her out. So clearly there is a lot to this story. We would like to take a look at that lease, and we plan to after we send it back to you.
All right, Taryn, so we know why the police won't get involved in this kind of thing. What about attorneys? I got to believe it's very difficult for either one of them to get an attorney because they're cash-strapped in the first place, which is why they're living under the same roof.
Well, yes, Heidi told us that she can't afford an attorney. She put everything into this house, right now she can't even afford to move anywhere, let alone pay for legal fees. But she said she needs one because there's no reason why there should be a lien against the property. In fact, that lien is in that woman's name, the supposed squatter here. So a lot of this stuff happening while she was gone. She said when she returned home, you know, there was a lot of changes to this house, stuff that she did not approve. So it sounds like it's going to be quite a legal battle, and you're right. She wishes she could afford an attorney right now. Back to you.
All right, Taryn Asher reporting to us.
All right, and that scenario is playing out rampant throughout the United States, but once again, to give you a picture, 86% of the population occupies just 3-5% of the available land mass. Once you get outside of that, you don't have these housing issues like that. And now, once again, it might require you to, or some people to develop new living skills, new lifestyle skills. I'll put it that way, new lifestyle skills. All right, so Chris Collins, he was on here a little while ago. He had to leave out. But Chris will be back here Monday. And we'll give you an update on what we'll be doing with him. And then, matter of fact, I haven't talked to Heidi Peterson. We've actually had Heidi on here probably about, I know she was on here at least once live, if not two times live, because I've actually met Heidi Peterson in person. I met her in South Florida, and then she and her daughter spent the night here right in this house where I'm at right now while she was, I think she's out of the state of Florida now. But that her house, we came into contact because the common denominator between her and I at the time I met her was we were dealing with squatters. So she had a house in Detroit that she had a squatter in, and then I had a house in D.C. that I had a squatter in. But I had to reach back out there. I haven't talked to her in quite a while. But matter of fact, we need to get her back on here and get an update from her, because she's no longer living in Michigan, I believe. The last time I saw a video of her, she was out in Washington State. That's the last time I talked to her. So, well, it's been a while since I spoke to her. But that's why we have Chris on here and others like Chris, because going back to the question of reparations is, you know, what form do you want reparations in? Do you want it as a check? Who do you want it from? That's another question. Who do you want it from? So I'm just saying, because the majority of people that are looking for reparations, and a different group, I mean, you have a group of Hawaiians, they want reparations, okay? Then you got Aitos. They want reparations, and they haven't come to any conclusive agreement on how they want it or who they want it from. All right. So, but I'm just saying, statistically speaking, you have over 2 billion acres of land that is outside of the 3-5% that is occupied by the 86% of the majority of the population of the United States. You know, it's practically Christmas every day, once you know where to look. And there's a lot of places from coast to coast where you can look. I'm in Florida, okay? Now, Florida has 67 counties. Now, the most populated counties are Dade, that's where, Miami's in Dade County, Broward County, you got Fort Lauderdale there. You got Pinellas and Hillsborough County, that's St. Petersburg and Tampa. That's about 30 minutes away from me. You got 45 minutes from me. You got Orange County. That's where Orlando is. You got Tallahassee. I don't know what that county that's in. Then you got Jacksonville. So you got Broward, Pinellas, Hillsborough, Orange County, the county where Tallahassee is, that's the state capital, that's 6. You got Jacksonville, that's in Duval County. So you got 7 counties out of 67 counties that are densely populated. All right. I'm going to throw in another county where I'm at, Polk County. Eight counties out of 67 counties that are heavily populated. The rest of Florida is rural. Right across the street from me right now, I look out my window. If I got up and walked, I'm sitting on the sofa. If I got out and walked down my driveway across the street, we're talking about no more than a 30-second walk, 34 to 45-second walk if I take my time walking. I got cows and horses. There's a citrus orchard that close to me, right across the street. Now, on my side of the street, it looks like a suburban, what do you call it, subdivision. I'm just telling you, my neighbor across the street, and he's on about at least 5 acres, if not more. That's what I see. I hear cows and see cows, and I see horses every day, right across the street. Not my side of the street, but across the street where the cows and horses are. And that citrus orchard, that's what I call the real United States of America. The real United States is not Miami, is not Fort Lauderdale, is not Jacksonville, is not New York City, is not St. Louis. It's not all those places, legally speaking, are in the United States, but it's not reflective of the average person that you're going to meet or average neighbor that you're going to meet in the United States. A good portion of my neighbors have pickup trucks that they use to get money. Now, they're pickup trucks in every city in the United States, but I'm just saying they're more prevalent here where I'm at. However, if we go to Miami, we'll see people riding around in Bentleys and Rolls Royces, particularly if you're around South Beach. But a lot of people, now, for me, my little 4 acres, now, I'm 3 hours away in the same state, but in order for me to get ahead of the game, I have to go rural. I'm not trying to get any type of government program. Actually, I'm not in the government programs at all, but I'm just saying. So when it comes to the topic of reparations, I'm just saying there's an infinite amount of opportunities once you step outside the 5%. Once you can psychologically get past that you need municipal water, you need a fire department, you need a police department. As Chris said, you bring the services to where you are. And that's what the black townships did when they built those. Whatever services they needed, they had the talent and the brain trust, and they organized the resources to put it together. And a lot of those towns to this day are over 100 years old. And you've heard me say it on here several times before. Eatonville, Florida is over 100 years old. They supply all the services that they need. So anyway, Chris will be back here on Monday because we're doing collabs, and we, as he mentioned earlier, we've done some offline telephone calls. So I've just known him a week as of today, so we'll bring that on. So, all right, now we got a few minutes left. So if you want to talk about anything, whatever's happening with Kanye West, I don't know what's happening. I've heard a lot, but I don't know what's happening with him. So we want to talk about that. There was a shooting in St. Louis. I saw one story on that yesterday with a mother and daughter, somebody, and I guess some shut up some school in St. Louis, Missouri. Want to talk about that. Or a text that I got earlier today, Native Americans and reparations. I have my point of view on that, but if you got your point of view, feel free to call in. Because I'm one of these, the glass is half empty. No, the glass is half full. I'm one of those type of guys. So I'm not looking at the problems on the 3-5%. I'm looking at the opportunity on the 95-97%. That's where I'm at with it. I don't care about redlining. What I care about redlining and squabbling over crumbs on the 3-5% where the redlining happens is where the crumbs are. I get whole loaves of bread and bakeries on the rural section. That's where I'm at with it. I'm looking at the abundance of the 97% of the over 2 billion acres of land in the United States versus the crumbs, because that, this is just me speaking. If you're looking to, if all you can see is what what people are scrapping over and struggling over and fighting over and shooting each other over and dying for on the 3.5%, where 86% of the population it doesn't make any sense to me. Whereas, once again, it just boggles my mind. There's uber abundance in this country. You don't have to worry about redlining in Podunk, Montana, or Arkansas, Oklahoma. You don't have to do it. However, and once again, I'll bring out and I go to the phone lines. Black Wall Street. At the same time that happened in 1921, once again, Black Wall Street was a neighborhood on 40 acres within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, at the same time that happened, there were 50 black township municipalities in the state of Oklahoma. I've been, for those who listen know, I've been to Tampa, Oklahoma several times, bought land there. Summit, Oklahoma, been there twice. And Tallahassee, Oklahoma, been there once. Been to Taft several times. Every time I go out there, I'm going to Taft. All right. Those townships are over 100 years old. Matter of fact, Taft and Tallahassee, those towns are older than the state of Oklahoma. All right. They're black townships. Taft, Oklahoma is the birthplace, and her childhood home is still standing. Somebody's still living in it, of Sarah Rector, who was a, we would call her black today, but she was registered as Native American. The picture of her is online. She was a very dark-skinned woman. She got her reparations in the form of, it was anywhere from 80 to 160 acres worth of what they thought at the time worthless land. It had oil on it. She became very wealthy because of that. But she wasn't the only one. Now, that Taft, Oklahoma is in Muskogee County, Oklahoma. Joseph Jake Simmons, a black man, his family had over 1,000 acres in Muskogee County, Oklahoma. And his net worth while he was alive was like something like $150 million. But now those two are not just outliers. There are records of over 1,000 black folk, many of them Native American, by legal description, over 1,000 black folk, colored folk, whatever you want to call them, were just like those two. Maybe not as rich as Joseph Jake Simmons or Sarah Rector, but they were wealthy. There were several oil tycoons or oil barons in the state of Oklahoma. You also had some in Texas. So I'm looking at that's what I call reparations. You can still go out today in 2022 going on in 2023, and you can go out and you can tap on, you got over 2 billion acres of land, you know what I mean, the select from. Granted, you might have to go out and get some new skills. Okay, you might have to learn something new, but so what? It, as Chris said earlier in today's podcast, you can go out and you can form a community, and you bring to your community the services that specific community needs. You do not. It's a lot easier. It'll come faster than marching and protesting. But that's the way I see it. It's the way I see it. The only way? No. There's an infinite amount of ways that you can accomplish this. But anyway, that's enough of what I got to say. Let's go to the phone lines here. 314, your mic is open. And Chris will be back here on Monday.
L.A., how you doing today?
I can't complain. I'm alive and good health and the sun is shining.
Well, you know, Jake Simmons was a Creek Indian. He wasn't no native black American. Did you know that?
Wait, now, hold it now. Let me get my language straight here. All right, I knew he was Native American. Oh, hold it. Curry, here's my question, Pianki. Is Native American and Cree Indian the same thing? I thought Native Americans were Indians.
No, you said he was a black man.
Oh, I stand correct.
American Negro.
All right, I stand correct.
Yeah. That's the same, you know, and I know where it comes from. It comes from that. It's a trick way of trying to bring people into your group or what you perceive as being your grouping to make it bigger, look larger than what it really is. And that goes on. I mean, it goes on with these different organizations from UNIA and the rest of them. You listen to how they talk. They say, we need to do this. We need to come to work. Who in the hell is we? You follow what I'm saying? And it's confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a trick way of doing things. But we're slowly bringing this to the people and showing them exactly what's going on.
Now, let me ask you this. So what you're saying is the people that identify as black, they're looking at skin and trying to bring them in by saying he and Sarah Rector, who by legal description
Sarah
were Native American.
Sarah Rector was a Creek Indian. They
right.
don't call themselves Native American.
I did not know that. All right, I did not know that. Thanks for the correction.
They don't call. So you got what you call Native, and you got then Indigenous. Indigenous was here when what you call Native American Indians came. That's why all the fighting was going on. Then you had the fighting going on between those Asians that came here that became known as Indians, which was a legal term based on the 1832 treaty. And today, like you just got through, call them Native American. So they came later. Indigenous was, nobody know where the hell they came from. It just popped up out of the ground. That's the Mayan, the Aztecs, the Taino. If you look at a Mexican, some Mexican, I had a Mexican real good friend of mine, and he's got that type size, that nose of the Mayan. You ever seen them paintings on the wall and they put a lot of distinction on their nose, kind of like a hook a little bit?
Okay.
That's there. You're going back to the indigenous Mayans, Aztecs, Taino, and some other ones of which I can't name.
Well, there were quite a few tribes.
Yeah, it was quite a few ethnic groups. Some of them still exist, stay down in the Amazon. But, you know, you talk about rural land. Rural land ain't worth nothing. That's why some people don't live out there. And it's nothing to do. That's just for people that wants to do something. Heck, you can take two or three blocks. How much you think two or three blocks in, say, a New York or a Chicago is worth, and how much land in the rural area
is going to be worth, in those two cities, is going to be worth billions because you have the population of people supplying demand. That's where they want to be, number one. And number two is, a lot of people just don't have the skill sets to develop land. Most people don't know how to grow their own food. They don't know how to catch it. Nor do they have the interest. And the person who loves tomatoes is really not interested in growing a tomato plant. That's just the reality of it.
You got land in Taft, right? You got land in Florida.
Right.
What's on?
And I'm not a farmer.
Right. And you living now where?
I'm in Lakeland, Florida. What I do have is I got a citrus orchard, like it's on the property I'm on right now. But that was started by my mother planted all those. And that just grows on its own now.
You're in Lakeland, Florida, living in what was your mom's big home. And that ain't what you would want to live in if you was to do something with those two pieces of land in Taft and I can't think of the other area you said. You talk about a whole something different. So that house
Completely different. Completely different.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what I'm talking about. People don't want to do that. Now, there are some. Like, for instance, Diane, I can't think of this lady's last name for that. They're on Pembroke, the old Nat Turner property that she had to scrape up money to save because of taxes. And it's out in the rural area, you still got to pay taxes, even if it's in the rural area. It may be a lot less, but you still got to pay it.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Amish, even they had to pay taxes. And they live in rural areas. But right. That's the way the system set it.
Go out their way.
Right.
And then you got to pay taxes toward the federal government to provide defense to keep countries like France, Germany, or Nigeria from invading you. So you just can't get away from that. Now,
that's
is it a good idea for people that want to do that? Yes. It's a nice idea, but you got to – I tell you where I'd rather live. I'd rather live up in Alaska myself. And that is really the wilderness. You have to fly things. And I know one lady I talked to.
You're right. Alaska is – you're right. A lot of Alaska, man has not even set foot in yet.
I know one lady
absolutely right.
To
some villages, you do have to fly in supplies and mail.
Yeah, I know one lady I talked to. She had a house. Her and her husband had a house. And they left and came back. The damn otters had taken it over. So they had to tear that place down and build a new one and make it otter-proof. So those are things you have to contend with, bears and everything else, but that's things you got to contend with.
Have to pick up different skill sets. You're going to have to learn new skill sets, and you're absolutely right. Out of the popular, I mean, for the most part, people that live in Western countries are Westernized, and you're not going to pull them out of the city.
Have you ever heard the blood flowing through your veins?
I never heard it, no.
All right. Well, if you go out in those areas, because I went out in Chesterfield, outside of St. Louis, and was building a firehouse. I went out there one afternoon after the job had shut down to do something. On the way out there, I had the air conditioning in my truck going and the radio. When I got out to the job site, I turned the engine off, stepped outside and shut the door, and it was so dead quiet that you could literally hear the blood flowing through your brain, veins.
That's
no
quiet.
No road noise, no nothing. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. What do you call Sodom quietness? And it's just tremendous. So that's what you would be faced with if you went up there and staked out in Alaska, other than the birds chirping and water rushing, if you got a stream coming by and listening to acorns fall. Because when I park, I can hear acorns falling off of trees that was at least 100 yards from me. So that's the type of sullenness that you experience. It's really cool, too, and especially at night. It's clear. Sky's clear. You can see the constellations and so on and so on. And
I know the quietest, and it can get quiet out in Taft, but I was up in Vermont, and I know what I had to walk to my cabin. The cabin was about a half mile from where I was at, and it was nighttime. And the first time I walked by myself, I couldn't even see my hand. But what got me through point A to point through to the cabin was the moonlight. It was enough moonlight where I can see my, you know, walk and get to the cabin. The second time I had to turn back and I had to borrow somebody's lantern and light my way. I'm just glad it wasn't no
If it was overcast,
no wildlife that I had to worry about.
In Ghana, there's an area up there in I think it's Takoradi. It's where the rubber plant, where Goodyear has a rubber tree plantation. And it's nothing but rubber trees. And you come off the road and walk back into those trees, it turns pitch black because the foliage is so dense that sunlight can't penetrate them. That's a requirement for a rubber tree to exist. And they got cans. Hang on for a second. They got cans with taps on the side of the tree to catch the rubber, the fluid that comes out, and that's what's collected collected in order to make rubber. And you can actually hear that dripping, drip, 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 all throughout the damn forest. So, and those are environments that people aren't used to.
And true, the average person is not used to that.
It's eerie when you experience those things. Hey, I set up on a cliff there in Louisiana, Missouri, when I was deer hunting, and I was up on a bluff overlooking the Mississippi River, and it was people down there fishing, and they was having a normal conversation, just like you and I have. Well, I can hear every word they saying where I was. I know I was at least a good 8th or 16th mile away from them. But that's the way things sound travels like that. I could hear their normal conversation that they was having between each other. That's just the way it is when you're in those environments.
That's true.
Now,
speaking of, go ahead, I'm listening.
As far as reparations are concerned, we get back to that same old issue. Who's going to pay and for what that you experienced? Your ancestors did not give you the right to adjudicate for them sometime in the future. That's a bunch of bull crap. Now, unless you live in some banana republic where everything goes, anything that can stick up beside the wall, well, that's the way it's going to be. Well, maybe it might work, but it ain't going to work here. And like you say, you got all these damn groups. You know the thing that with me, once again, with that trickery, why don't they just compile a list of everybody in that organization? 5 people, 10 people, 15 or 20 people, put their name on their list, and that's what they call themselves, ADOs. That's what they call themselves. We seek reparations. We demand reparations. That's what they call themselves. And stop trying to include all black people in that, because all black don't want to get involved in that stuff anyway. In those annex. I mean, do you see anything other than that yourself, L.A.? You a wise, intelligent young man.
Well, my position is, that's why I said go out and get your own. I'm not looking for the government. And then when you're looking at reparations, well, all right, I'm looking at it from a legal standpoint of view. How can you prove, now, what doctor, okay, what legal authority, it could be a physician, psychiatrist, whatever, how can you prove that you have been harmed in 2022 by something that happened
illegally
in 1865?
Illegally harmed.
Right.
Because the person breaking your house, they have done illegal things to harm you. That there's a crime.
Now, what happened? Now, let me put this out there. We have to look at some words here. We have to look, make some very important distinctions. What's illegal and what's legal has nothing to do with what's right or wrong or what's moral or immoral. Legal is what's allowable and not allowable. Once again, it has nothing to do with right or wrong. Look up the definitions of right and wrong. Look up the definition of legal and illegal. All right. Now, in July 4th, 1776, the people who signed that Declaration of Independence, and before that, human trafficking, slavery, whatever you would call it, was permissible and what we now call, the matter of fact, the entire Western Hemisphere. There was no laws on the books. There was no government as we know it today. There were no government agencies. So we can't take today's government and today's agencies and apply it to what happened back then.
You're absolutely
matter
right.
Of fact,
Some people can't see. Identify what happened last week, less long, 100 years ago.
Right. If you look up this name online, Anthony Johnson, colonist, on Wikipedia. It's a Wikipedia page on Anthony Johnson. He was what we would call today a black man. He was, I think, born in what we would call today Ghana. He came over here as an indentured servant, got his freedom. And he became a very wealthy farmer. He is, you can sort of look at him as the architect of slavery for this country. But read about him.
Well, he was
Anthony Johnson Collins.
He wouldn't have been the beginning person who.
No, he wasn't the beginning.
Yeah,
but
he
had
was,
a documented
he
case here in this country.
If I was living back then, I probably would have bought some, too. Those are for folks who had ingenious minds, intuitive, wanted to get something done, and they seen a way to do it. Just like if you was to plow land, would you get out some mules and a wooden plow, or would you get out a John Deere or a harvester tractor?
Mm.
Combine. What would you use?
All right, hold on, Pianki. Let me read this real quick to answer your question. All right, Anthony Johnson, I'm reading online right now. He's known for being the most prominent early colonial black person to own a slave. Okay, Anthony Johnson, and people can read this on Wikipedia. He was born 1600. He transitioned in 1670, was a black Angolan known for achieving wealth in the early 17th century colony of Virginia. He wasn't the only one, but he was just one of many. All right. He was one of the first African-Americans, or what we call African-American today, all right, whose right to own a slave for life was recognized by the Virginia court. He held as an indentured servant in 1621. He earned his freedom after several years and was granted land by the colony. All right. He later became a tobacco farmer in Maryland. He attained great wealth after completing his term as an indentured servant and had been referred to as the black patriarch of the first Negro community of property owners in the United States. And like I said, you can read about him and the more details about him. Now, there were other people like him. All right. I'm just saying. See, this is why I don't watch slave movies coming out of Hollywood. They don't tell any Anthony Johnson stories.
Yeah, but listen to what that story, what that article described. First, they call him an Angolian. Then they call him a Negro. Then they call him an African American. The man was an Angolian, and he came here.
Correct.
And he came in what year? 1600. Well, you had African chiefs that brought their slaves, who came along with Columbus in one or two voyages, and started rice farming there in what's now called the Carolinas. That was in the 1400s. That's some of that critical race theory stuff that you just read that's really inaccurate all over the place, from Angolan, African American, to Negro. You see what people be complaining about when they say, we want to teach this. Well, what you want to teach is not accurate. And why you want to teach that stuff to other people? I mean, it does make a difference, doesn't it? You ain't going to call no person that just came from Nigeria an African American because he got black skin. It gets back to the point again that we have today. Is it the skin color or is it the politics? Look at that dumb Al Sharpton, how he – right. Look how that dumb Al Sharpton is ridiculing Herschel Walker, talking about he's a disgrace to black people. How is he a damn – he's got a right to run for office. What it is that you have taken on the position of gatekeeper of black people and being paid for it. And you believe that you control the thoughts, behavior, opinions, and lifestyles of blacks in America. You don't speak for all of them. You got an organization called, what's this organization? Action Network. That's your people you speak to. Leave everybody else the hell alone.
That's Al Sharpton's group. That's Al Sharpton's pride.
Didn't that message come over? You come over clear to you and Jesse? In 2014, during the incident in Ferguson, when them young people gathered together and told you to get your ass out of here? So the way he is on, the way he's on,
I remember when,
criticizing.
I remember when Rodney King, that whole incident happened. The people of the black community of Los Angeles told Al Sharpton not to come to L.A.
But he does
have his own tribe, though.
He's got his own agenda. And then you got just the same way you got the thing that Kanye West is going through. And you got these groups coming out against him. And then you got these groups that disassociating with him business-wise, because they wanted to use him in order to favorably offer their commodities to a certain segment of the population in the United States. And actually, he was going beyond that because he had a large Asian following so that they could sell him. And out of that, they would give him a commission. $200 million is a commission of what? Either a billion, $10 billion, or $20
billion. Right.
So if I was Kanye, if you was Kanye West, what would you have done, Mr. Ellie?
Well, Kanye, I can't speak for
now,
Kanye.
If you was Kanye West, what would you have been doing? Would you take the Michael Jordan route?
There you go. I take the mouth, and when I say I take the Michael Jordan route, is I'm keeping my mouth shut.
Keeping your mouth shut and going on about doing business. That's it.
That's just
me. Would you be going back to the hood and the corners and that, visiting your friends once or twice a week or maybe a month? Will you just send them postcards and Christmas cards?
That's about it. I'm a business person, not a politician. I'm not a social engineer, nor am I an activist.
That's right.
So I would take the Michael Jordan route all day long.
You stay the hell away from them. If you don't, they're going to be robbing you. They either going to be robbing you through persuasion, or they're going to be physically robbing you, like breaking into your house, like they've done the Honorable Judge Joe Brown. 6 times the Negroes in the neighborhood broke in his house. And all the stuff that he does for black, all the programs, the donations and that. And that's the way these people show you. That's why Africans got rid of them. Some of that DNA still exists today in these idiots. That's why the people in the tribes got rid of them. They ain't going to get rid of something good that they could use. It probably wasn't good for anything then. They got rid of them. They probably caused a whole bunch of mayhem, act out in criminal ways. You know another thing you was talking about these squatters. How long do you think a squatter would last over there in Africa occupying somebody's residence, hut, or on their land? What do you think would happen to them?
Not long.
You're damn right. That stuff about getting lawyers going to court is the way they do it here, whereas you should have a damn baseball bat, a Louisville Slugger, busting some kneecaps. That'll get them out of there real fast, don't you think?
Well, matter of fact, even in this country, if you're in certain areas, you wouldn't last a day.
Right. You don't go up in nobody's damn house. That's why white folks are moved away from some of these people.
In the state that you mentioned earlier today, Alaska, you know, once you get outside of Fairbanks or Juneau or someplace like that, and you got your cabin somewhere in Alaska, you are the law.
You and your Winchester. You're absolutely right. And the thing about it up there,
you are the law.
Every citizen, every legal citizen, a registered citizen in Alaska, receives royalties every year from the extraction and the export of energy commodities in the form of oil and natural gas. That's the way it should be. Same thing would happen here, except that damn federal government. The same thing would happen in states here in America, like Oklahoma, Texas. When you talk about the offshore, and if that state within its side borders claim everything out to international waters to be taxed, then that could be shared with the people of that state, those revenues, rather than going to the federal government in Washington, D.C. You
right.
Follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right.
All right.
Well, Bianchi, it's after one here, 3 after 1. I'm going to shut it down before Blog Talk shuts me down. So
all right.
Thank
well,
you
I'll
for
talk
the
to you later.
Talk to you. Have a good weekend. Everybody had a good weekend. We'll be back on, well, we do Sunday nights now, but that's like a 5 or 10 minute like pep talk for the week. Sunday evenings at 7, but that's like a 10 or 15 minute show. That's motivational type, you know, just start the week all right. So that's at 7 p.m. Sunday night. But we'll be back in a second.